camp and walk until the sun starts to drop. I want to push on after that, but Dalton says no. We're less than halfway home, with no chance of making it back without more sleep. Better to find a spot and get our shelter up before it's fully dark. We're in bed by 6, asleep 1.5 seconds later. As exhausted as we are, though, we don't need 12 hours of sleep, so we're on our way again by 3 in the morning, our flashlights leading us through the darkness. It's nearly noon when we reach Rockton, and I can say with absolute certainty that these were the most physically strenuous 3 days of my entire life. Dalton's promise of an entire batch of fresh baked cookies may be the only thing that gets me through the last 10 kilometers. I'm holding him to that, too, and washing them down with multiple mugs of spiked coffee, followed by an afternoon nap that may last until morning. I reach the town perimeter and topple face first into the snow. Or I try to, but my feet tangle in the snowshoes, and Dalton grabs me before I snap my ankle with my drama queen gesture. He lifts me over his arms, and I struggle to get out, saying, "I'm fine, just being a brat. Too late, I'm carrying you." I start to settle in. Then he flips me over his shoulder, firefighter style, which is a whole lot less flattering. "No, no, no," I say, renewing my struggles. "Just let me." "Too late. You can't embarrass you by carrying you over my shoulder through town." "Yep, I believe I can." Storm starts dancing around us, barking, finding her second wind. I grab the back of Dalton's parka and yank, and I'm just goofing around, but it's hard enough to make him stagger. And apparently Storm chooses that moment to cut in front of him, and we all go down in a heap of curses and yelps and giggles. As we untangle ourselves, a voice says,
"First you disappear for 3 days. Now you are napping at noon. I understand the holidays are coming, but as a taxpayer, I object."
I twist to see Matthias standing there. "Since when do you pay taxes?"
"I treat each and every person in this community with marginal respect. It is very taxing."
We untangle, and Dalton and Storm rise as I snap off my snowshoes. "What are you doing out and about?"
"There is caroling. It began at 10 in the morning. After 2 hours, my choices were to walk in the forest or begin a quiet but relentless slaughter of the offenders. Knowing the latter would force you to work through the holidays, I chose the former. It is my gift to you."
"Thanks." We start for the town. Matthias falls in beside me.
"Also, speaking of relentless, we must discuss this constant flow of visitors you have unleashed on our peaceful village, Casey."
"Peaceful?"
Dalton says. "Where have you been living?"
"In a town where people do not wander in from the forest and make themselves at home. Your detective is the Pied Piper of the Yukon, leading people to our town with her charming manner and sunny disposition."
I look at Dalton. "You have another detective?"
"Compared to me, you are pretty damn charming. Not sure about sunny, but people definitely find you less intimidating than me, which just means they don't know you very well."
Dalton turns to Matthias.
"Yeah, we've been doing more outreach since Casey's been here. Building relationships with the community really wasn't my strength, apparently. If you're talking about Tyrone, I'd rather not, really. Mr. Cipher has chosen his alias well. I do not know what to make of him, and I have decided he is a puzzle I do not care to solve. The problem is that the procession of strays does not end. I discovered only today that you had a hostel in town, a live hostel, which you promised me for study, and you whisked her in and out without a word to me."
"You requested a hostel," I say. "I chose to deny that request."
"Instead, you give me other strays, a wolf and a feral boy."
"First, you asked for Raoul. Plenty of people wanted him, and you got him, and therefore you owed me a favor, which you repaid by taking Sebastian, who is a resident, not a stray, also not feral."
"He spent half his life being raised by narcissists who treated him as a fashion accessory, and he spent the other half imprisoned for their murders.
He may have learned very pretty manners, but Sebastian is as feral as that half-breed dog, and I have spent 6 months sleeping with one eye open, wondering which will kill me first."
I could point out that Sebastian doesn't live with Matthias, but instead I shrug as we enter town.
Fine. Give me the dog. Our deputy will be thrilled to have...
It is too late. Raoul is accustomed to me.
Then I'll take Sebastian back, and
he is accustomed to me as well. And it is my duty to monitor him for the sake of the town. No one else is equipped or trained for such a task.
You're just bitching for the sake of bitching, aren't you?
I do not bitch. I simply point out that you need to stem this flow of strays. You have barely removed one when another takes her place.
I stop and look at him.
What? You have a visitor. She is in the town square. William attempted to show her the hospitality of the police station, but she is another of your wild things and refuses to go indoors. She is with Raoul and Sebastian. Raoul is guarding her. Sebastian is, he purses his lips. I am not certain what he is doing. Perhaps drinking in the rare beauty of this wilderness flower. Perhaps considering the myriad ways he could kill her with maximum efficiency, should she prove a threat. He may be doing both simultaneously. It is Sebastian. I pick up my pace, breaking into a jog as I shout back,
Next time, Matthias, cut the preamble and get to the damned point.
That would be no fun at all, he calls after me.
Chapter 35. When Matthias says we've attracted another woman from the woods, hinting she's young and attractive, my first thought is Charisse. Yet when I draw close, I spot a small dark-haired figure, one who is younger and significantly more welcome than Charisse. It's Edwin's granddaughter, Felicity. Sebastian is neither gaping at her nor plotting her demise. He's playing host, pulling out his charm and his manners and his high society upbringing, telling Felicity a story complete with blazing smiles and dramatic gestures. There's no flirtation there. Yes, she's his age and pretty, but if he's noticed that, he's tucked it aside, as if it would be rude to see her as anything but a guest in need of hospitality. As for Felicity, I remember when I was 13, and my mother sent me to finishing school. Okay, it wasn't called finishing school. I'm not sure those exist anymore, and I sure as hell wouldn't have attended. It was billed as weekly classes for teen girls to learn teen girl stuff. Everything from putting on makeup to protecting yourself online. I might never have been the most feminine girl, but I was not opposed to learning the secret language of stiletto heels and smoky eyeliner. While the class offered that, it was more like a finishing school, with lessons for privileged young ladies to learn to act like privileged young ladies. I was privileged. I took private lessons and flew business class. Well, unless there weren't enough seats, and then my parents put April and me in economy, supposedly as a lesson so we'd grow up vowing to get the kind of careers that meant we never needed to fly coach again. The point is that those girls should have been my people. Except I was a half-Asian tomboy from the suburbs, and they were all white, elegant, and city-bred. I felt like a gawky country girl stumbling into a debutante ball. That's how Felicity looks sitting beside Sebastian. She follows his story stone-faced, her gaze locked on him in a look of barely concealed panic. Not so much transfixed as held captive, fearing if she moves a single muscle, she'll reveal herself as a teenager from a very different planet than the one this self-assured and animated boy clearly inhabits. When Sebastian sees me, he smiles and stands with, Hey, Casey. And I swear Felicity deflates in relief. I was keeping Felicity company while she waited, he says, talking her ear off with my boring stories. He flashes a smile her way. Sorry.
Yes. Color rises on her cheeks. I mean, yes, you were keeping me company. No, your stories were not boring.
She flails a moment, as if struggling to find the girl I met the other day, the one who'd been equally self-assured in her natural environment.
I came to talk to you, Casey.
And now you can, Sebastian says. You're free of my awkward hospitality.
Yes, another mortified flush. I mean, yes, she's here, and yes, you do not need to stay with me any longer. Thank you for keeping me company. It was very kind.
He grins. My pleasure. I will leave you in Casey's capable hands.
He jogs off, and Felicity watches him go. How old is he? She asks tentatively.
19. He's our youngest resident.
Oh, I am 18. Angus is 20, and that boy seems older. But he didn't look it, so I thought...
I suppose that is how boys are down south.
Not exactly, I say. Sebastian is a special case, but I'm glad he kept you company. He was very entertaining. His stories were funny.
She takes a deep breath, throwing off any lingering discomfiture, and turns to me.
I have information you want. I would like to trade for it.
I glance around. Dalton's taken Storm to get her stitched up at the clinic, and he's left me to this.
All right, I say. Let's go into the police station. I would prefer to stay outside.
May we at least leave the town square? Everyone can hear our conversation here.
She nods, and we begin walking. You found a baby, she says. That's why you came to my grandfather.
You didn't tell me that. You should have.
Edwin had already told us where to find the baby's parents. He lied.
So we discovered, I mutter. The clothing came from the second settlement, not the trading family he sent us to.
Did you speak to the traders? I nod. And what did you think?
You were right. Not the sort of people I care to do business with.
They can trade fairly. The problem is that we only use them when we must, and then they know how badly we need their supplies, so we pay far too much. Grandfather would prefer not to do business with them. He'd rather do business with you.
Understandable. We'd rather do business with him.
Good.
She slows to look up at a decorated pine towering over us.
I imagine her assessing not the beauty of the object, but the relative wealth that it requires, the expenditure of both time and goods.
It's the holidays, I say. Time to celebrate the solstice. She nods.
We do that as well. We do not string berries in trees, though.
The birds will appreciate them, she snorts.
The birds that come for those will not be good eating.
Apparently, she thinks our decorated trees are luring dinner. I'm about to say not everything is about food, but fortunately, I do nothing so thoughtless. For settlers, everything is about food, or shelter, or basic survival. People enjoy seeing the birds, I say simply.
You sound like those from the second settlement.
I glance over at her. I thought you didn't have contact with them. She shrugs.
That is my grandfather's way. It is their elders' way. It is not our way.
She pauses to watch a few residents race by, sliding on the packed snow and laughing like children. She shakes her head.
It is different here.
They're just on lunch break before their afternoon shift.
So you met the second settlement, she says. What did you think of them?
Interesting. A snort.
That is one way to put it. They have ideas. Odd ideas. They won't trade with you, though.
Not the way we will. I got that impression. She nods, satisfied.
My grandfather should have let you go to them. There's nothing to fear. He just worries.
She looks at me.
I would like a gun.
So you've said. But right now, we're still busy trying to find this baby's parents.
That is why I'm here. To trade. It is also why you should have told me about the baby. I know who it belongs to.
Do you? I say, keeping my voice calm.
Oddly, your grandfather said the same thing. Those traders also tried to claim her. Is it a her?
Something flickers in her eyes, gone before I can chase it. She nods.
You have been fed many lies, but I tell the truth.
In return for a gun?
Yes.
I face her.
Yeah, here's the problem with that. Edwin told us the baby was from these traders in hopes we'd keep her and avoid contact with the second settlement.
The traders told us she was theirs in hopes we'd pay them for her.
Now you're telling us you know where she belongs in hopes of getting a gun. See the pattern? We've spent a damned week tramping through the forest trying to give a family back their lost baby. This doesn't benefit us at all, and everyone else is trying to benefit from our good deed. And I'm getting really pissed off.
If you don't actually know who this baby's parents are, then I'd suggest you turn around right now and go back to the first settlement, or you are never going to see a gun from me. She eyes me, much the way she might eye a wolf in the forest, trying to decide exactly how dangerous it is. You're frustrated. How very astute of you. Her lips quirk. I won't call it a smile, but it's something. She might be appreciating my directness, or she might be amused at my show of weakness, allowing my temper to get the better of me. No one out here will reward you for your good deeds, she says. I'm not looking for a reward, I know. You want us to help or stay out of your way. Instead, we're making your task unnecessarily difficult. Yes, she eyes me again, head tilting, as if considering. Then she says, it is a test. Not intentionally or overtly, but in the end, you are being tested. Do you see through the lies? How easily are you manipulated? How much can you be used? That's what everyone out here is thinking. How useful can you be to them? And you are thinking the same thing. Can the first settlement be useful? The second? The traitors? Tyrone? Jacob? She lifts a hand against my protest. Yes, Jacob is Eric's brother, and you are not trying to use him, but it is still a reciprocal relationship. Your goal is not to take advantage, but to establish mutually beneficial relationships. Everyone else is doing the same. They're just less concerned about making those relationships fair. Everyone wants the best deal. You would not take advantage of Jacob. You might not even take advantage of me because I am young. But if you could take advantage of those traitors, of course you would. Everyone wants something. No one wants to be cheated. She's right, of course. That isn't only life up here. It's life in general. It's just more obvious here. Everyone angling for an advantage over the limited resources we share. They are testing you, she says. You're a good person. The question is, how good? And can it be used against you? You ask whether I'm lying. I'd be a fool to do that, wouldn't I? It would be cheating you on our first trade. Foolish and short-sighted, like a bear trampling an entire berry patch for one meal. Better to cultivate the patch. And you're cultivating me. You know I am. There's no point in lying. Also, I don't do it. That's my grandfather's way, and it works for him. It does not work for me. If I don't want to tell you the truth, I won't answer. When I say I know where to find this baby's parents, I'm negotiating in good faith. I'll take you to them, and then you owe me a gun. You'll hold this child hostage for a gun. Something flashes behind her eyes. Then her jaw sets, and she says simply, I would like a gun. I believe finding this baby's parents is important to you, and therefore worth the price I'm asking. If I don't want to tell you the truth, I won't answer. I remember her expression when I said the baby was a girl, that flicker of emotion. You know her parents, I say. Did I not say that? She snaps, annoyed at being more transparent than she intended. I will pay you for this information, I say. $500 worth of our goods or $250 of your choice to be purchased in Dawson. Her eyes harden. That means nothing to me. I wince. Of course. Unlike Charisse, who travels to Dawson, Felicity has never used money. Right. Sorry. $500 would buy you 5 good pairs of boots or 5 decent parkas or 500 cans of soup. She tries to cover her shock and says nonchalantly, how many guns? I smile. Nice try. But if the council caught us buying guns for you, they'd kick us out. Later, I can try to negotiate to get you one, but I can't promise that now. It's the 500 in random goods or 250 in goods of your choice, same as I offered Charisse. She blinks. You offered Charisse so much for finding this baby's parents? That was unwise, she says it carefully, an adult gently admonishing a child too young to know better. In retrospect, it probably was. Fortunately, it seems I'll be paying you instead. I will take your goods minus the price of a gun, which you will get me before spring, or pay me double its value in additional goods. That's fair,
but I pretend to consider it before agreeing. The baby's mother is from the first settlement, she says. She was a companion of mine. We'd meet up with a couple of the second settlers around our age. My grandfather doesn't know this, and I would appreciate you not telling him.
I won't. I'm sure he's seen it with others, though. You're two small communities with a limited number of people your own age. Down south, that had been like the kids from neighboring small-town schools hanging out together.
I smile.
It widens the dating pool.
She frowns, and I'm about to explain when she figures it out, deciphering unfamiliar words from the context.
You mean our choices for marriage prospects, she says, or just romantic relationships?
A wave of one hand, dismissing the concept. I suppose to them, dating would be similar to wooing 100 years ago. There's always an end goal, and that goal is finding a marriage partner.
I sought out their young settlers for an exchange of ideas, she says. I see advantage in that where my grandfather does not. We hunted together. We camped together. We grew close.
You became friends. A twist of her lips. This is a girl who sees friendship, like romance, as a frivolity for those who can afford to be frivolous, and she cannot.
You became allies, I say, and she nods, clearly more comfortable with that.
But your friend, your companion, found more. She found a marriage partner.
Felicity's face darkens. That was not supposed to happen. Intermarriage between the communities is forbidden.
I chuckle. When it comes to romance, nothing tastes as sweet as the forbidden fruit.
People have written 1,000 stories about it. Romeo and Juliet, she says, her lip curling.
I must look surprised because she gives me just the faintest hint of an eye roll.
We are not savages. The first generation brought their stories, and my grandfather brought books. We all know Romeo and Juliet, a ridiculous tale of 2 foolish dolts.
I have to smile at that.
They were very young. I heard the story when I was younger than the characters, and my reaction was no different. Romeo is madly in love with some other girl, sees Juliet, and falls madly in love with her. The boy wanted to be madly in love, nothing more.
I'm not disagreeing.
Even Sidra said Romeo and Juliet were dolts.
And then what does she do?
Falls madly in love with a boy from the second settlement and runs away with him.
Felicity harumphs.
They might as well have committed suicide. For all I know, she died in childbirth with no one to help her.
Felicity's face stays dark, scowling, but I see the fear in her eyes. Fear and worry and hurt. The baby has been well fed, I say. She'd need her mother alive for that.
She nods, the relief seeping out. Then she snaps. Then Sidra was lucky. But what about next time? Is she going to continue breeding with him? Without any help? I could have—
Her teeth shut with a click, and she retreats into a deeper scowl.
Dolts!
You didn't know she was pregnant, I say softly.
How could I? She left the summer before last, and I warned her that if she went, I wouldn't—
Felicity swallows and doesn't finish.
You said you wouldn't help her, but you didn't really mean that.
She took you seriously and stayed away.
I was angry. I begged her to stay, not to give him up. I knew better than to ask that. But if she'd given me time, I could have brought grandfather around to the idea. She didn't even give me time to ask him. She staged her own death like Juliet. Can you believe that? They both did, the fools. They left bloodied clothing, and I was supposed to grieve as if she died.
Her jaw tightens.
I didn't. That would feel like a lie. So I pretended I didn't believe she died, and everyone thinks I just can't handle the truth.
She put you in a very awkward position.
Yes, she did. Grandfather listens to me. But she didn't trust me. She thought if she asked, they'd marry her off to Angus. I've known her since we were babies, and she was very important to me, and I was not so important to—
A deep breath as she blinks back tears and straightens.
She chose him. She met him, and she chose him, and she forgot me.
It's an old story. Diana accused me of shunning her when I fell for Dalton.
Of course, that ignores the fact that she dumped me with every new boyfriend since we were in high school together. Also, the entire reason I'm in Rockton is because she and her ex conspired to convince me I'd been found out for Blaine's murder. This has, I suspect, been the complaint of friends since time immemorial. A romantic partner shouldn't replace a best friend, but they are competition for that role. In circumstances like mine, your lover is also your friend. Yet it's not like simply adding a new friend to the mix because you want plenty of alone time with this one. That leaves your best friends to the time-worn wail of, "You're always with them," devolving into the desperate battle cries of, "Bros before hoes and chicks before dicks." I doubt Cedra forgot Felicity. It just feels that way. As much as I value my friendships, no one can ever be as close to me as Dalton. We work together, play together, live together, plan our futures together. That doesn't mean I fail to understand Felicity's hurt. I felt it myself every time Diana swanned off with a new lover, forgetting me until a hole in her social calendar needed filling. I could give Felicity advice, but she won't want it. She needs to work this out for herself. Instead, I ask if she has any idea where to find Cedra and her partner. She doesn't know exactly where they're camping, but she has a rough idea. The region is about a half day's walk from here, in the direction of where we found Abby. "May I see the baby?" she asks. "Of course." Chapter 36. Petra has Abby while Jen naps. We pass Dalton, who strides by with a gesture that I think means he'll catch up with us, but he's moving too fast for me to be sure. I call after him that we'll be at Petra's, and he lifts a hand in acknowledgement without slowing. When Petra opens the door to Felicity, she does a subtle shift into the young woman's line of sight, as if blocking her from seeing Abby. "This is Felicity," I say. "She's Edwin's granddaughter. She's a friend of the baby's mom." Petra nods, but she's still wary as she escorts us in. We find Abby in a wooden cradle that someone has painted with a carousel of wild animals.
"We're gone 3 days, and you guys have built her a cradle and decorated it."
"She was in a box," Petra says. "A cardboard box." I lift a fur teddy bear from the floor and sigh, shaking my head. Abby's eyes open and her head rolls as her lips purse in what threatens to be a wail if I don't pick her up in the next 2 seconds. I scoop her out of the cradle and hug her, crooning under my breath. She snuggles in and then stops, head rolling again. "No, Eric isn't here," I say. "You have to make do with me." "Daddy's little," Petra begins, and then her gaze shunts to Felicity and she stops herself. This isn't our baby. She has parents, and unless they abandoned her, she's going back to them. Still, Petra's lips tighten as she assesses Felicity again. I turn to Felicity, who hasn't said a word. I hold out Abby, and she just stands there, looking at her. Then she touches one finger to the baby's cheek. "Does she look like your friend?" Petra asks, and there's challenge in that, as if she's going to make damned sure we aren't being misled. "She looks like a baby," Felicity says. "My friend does not." I smile at that. "True." "Cedra has skin the color of mine," she says. "Her grandmother was Arab. That's what grandfather called her. Cedra has dark hair and blue eyes. The boy, Baptiste, is French. He also has dark hair, but lighter skin and brown eyes. I see nothing that says this baby is not theirs, but they will need to confirm that, of course." I explain the full situation, and Petra only says, "So you don't even know if your friends had a baby?" "We'll confirm it, like Felicity says." I counter. Now, 2 sharp knocks at the door, and I see Dalton through the front window, something in his hands. Petra calls a welcome, and the door clicks open and then smacks into the wall as if he has his hands full.
"You breaking down my door, Sheriff?"
Petra calls as she walks into the front hall.
"Ah, you come bearing gifts. You're forgiven. You will have to pay the toll, though."
"Better ask Casey. I promised her a whole batch."
He walks in with an insulated box and a thermos. Abby has her head up again, wobbling toward him.
Someone hears you, I say. Trade? He takes the baby and I get the treats. The thermos holds spiked coffee, and the box is stuffed with chocolate chip cookies, warm from the oven. Oh my God, I say, I love you.
I keep my promises.
He hefts Abby, talking to her. While I know it's gas, I swear she smiles up at him.
How about you, kiddo? You want a cookie? Irish coffee? Make you sleep really well tonight and let us get some rest?
Abby coos at him. She has parents, Felicity says.
Everyone does. I'm hoping that means you can help us get her back to them.
Felicity hesitates. There's annoyance in her gaze, offended on her friend's behalf at this man who's playing with Abby as if she's his. Not unlike Petra eyeing Felicity, ready to defend my claim on the baby. I tell Dalton about Cedra and Baptiste as I pass out cookies. Felicity examines hers and then takes a tiny bite, startling at the taste and pulling back as if poisoned. What is this? She says, touching her fingertip to a gooey chocolate chip. Fruit gone bad? Does it taste bad? I say.
Don't say yes,
Dalton says,
or she won't let you finish that cookie. Casey is very protective of her chocolate chips.
This is chocolate? Felicity touches it again. I've heard of it in books. She puts her fingertip in her mouth, tasting it and then nodding. It's good. I just didn't know what it was. She lifts the cookie. And this is a cookie? Yep. I take a mug from Petra as she brings them. This is coffee, spiked with brandy. Alcohol, which you are, by Yukon law, 1 year too young to drink. We don't drink it anyway, she says. It is forbidden. Well, you can try it, or we can brew you a regular cup. She considers and then accepts a quarter cup. We sit and make plans for tracking Abby's parents. It's too late to head out today, so we'll start before dawn. Felicity will come with us. She insists before I can offer. She's making sure her tip is the one that leads us to Abby's parents and there's no wiggle room to claim otherwise. Or that's what she says. The truth, I suspect, is that she wants the excuse to reunite with her friend. Stubborn pride. The kind that only hurts yourself, that stops you from having something you really want because God forbid anyone should think you want anything. I understand that. I understand it all too well. You can stay in my old place, I say. Felicity shakes her head. I have a tent and blankets. I will camp outside your town.
Yeah, no,
Dalton says.
First, you don't trust us to play fair with your lead, and we don't trust you not to send us on a wild goose chase like your granddaddy did.
I would not.
Second, I cannot allow anyone to camp outside our town. You are a guest here, but you're also an intruder. You'll sleep where I tell you to sleep.
She can stay here, Petra says. Dalton and Petra exchange a look. Petra isn't being hospitable. She wants Felicity under watch. When Dalton's gaze slips my way, I hesitate. Petra is the council's tool. She has killed for them. She has also vowed that her loyalties lie with Rockton itself over the council and even her grandmother. At what point is a lack of trust simply caution? And at what point does it tip into pride? You hurt me. I feel betrayed. I understand that it wasn't about me, but I want to stand my guard. Keep that door shut so you can't hurt me again. That's what I feel, and it is exactly what I suspect Felicity does with Cedra. I'll go with you tomorrow, too, Petra says when I finally agree. We shouldn't take the baby, Felicity says, so we won't need you to look after her. Petra looks at Felicity and bursts out laughing. Yeah, kid, I'm offering to go along as the babysitter. You just keep thinking that. She turns to me. I'm guessing you'll take Abby tonight and— Her name is Abby? Felicity says. How do you know that? Her expression says she's guessed the answer and she'd better be wrong. We don't know what Cedra and Baptiste named her, I say, but we needed something to call her. It doesn't mean anything. Felicity's gaze moves to the painted cradle and the toys. Then she looks back at me. Yes, I say. We have too much free time here. People wanted to do something for the baby. Cedra will be welcome to take anything they've made. Now, I think we should... I'd like to go along tomorrow, Petra repeats, as if I've forgotten the request. Technically, she should ask Dalton, but her gaze is on me. When I don't answer, she says, Will has to stay in town. Tyrone is still here, but you'd need to pry him away from Jen. Also, with you both being gone for a few days, it's been easier on Will having Tyrone around playing backup deputy. We've already found Ellen's killer, I say. This is a simple tracking mission. I'm not even sure both Eric and I need to go. Dalton's grunt tells me I am mistaken in this. I have tomorrow off, Petra says, and I'm requesting permission to accompany you. Who knows, maybe you'll find another baby along the way and need someone to look after it. She shoots an amused glance at Felicity. She's really saying that she doesn't trust this girl, doesn't trust we aren't being led into a trap. If I refuse the request, I'm being stubborn and maybe a little petty. All right, I say.
Good,
Dalton says.
Now, Felicity, I'm guessing no one has given you a tour of the town?
No, but I don't need...
We insist. It's only polite. Get your stuff on, and we'll show you around.
Dalton doesn't insist on the tour to be hospitable. It's a message, one Felicity can take home to the first settlement, like when I told her how we store our guns and how tightly they're controlled. He also shows her that, as part of the tour. We have guns, more than you do, and they're locked up so tight even our residents can't get at them. So don't even think about stealing any. We introduce her to the militia and explain the 24-hour armed guard patrols. We show her the storehouses, windowless and well-secured. Of course, Felicity realizes what's happening. But we don't need to point out the security features. She's already looking and calculating. At first, I'm surprised she initially declined the tour. She's Edwin's granddaughter, and this is a rare opportunity to assess our wealth and defenses. She must be curious, too. That, I realize, is where I'm mistaken. Yes, she's curious, but she's also wary, and this is why she didn't want to come inside, because she didn't want to see more. I had a friend in elementary school who was from a less affluent part of the city. I know that private and charter schools are popular in the States, speaking to the quality of the public school system in some areas. In Canada, private schools are for the rich. My parents used to say they were for parental bragging rights. That's not entirely true. But our public school system is good enough that parents like mine rightly declared a private education unnecessary. But there are still differences between schools themselves. And this girl's parents drove her to ours. We became friends. And one day I got permission to bring her home. I'd been so excited to show her my house with my big bedroom and private bath and huge yard. That wasn't showing off. I was too young to understand such a thing. I just wanted her to see my domain, the places that were uniquely mine. When I invited her back, she refused, and an invitation to her home never came. It's only now, as an adult, that I understand. My house was a glimpse into a world of privilege. A world where you don't share your bedroom with two sisters and your bathroom with your entire family. Where you don't bother with the neighborhood playground because your yard is bigger. Where you can open the fridge and eat whatever you want because it'll be replaced as soon as it's gone. In my house, she saw what she lacked through sheer happenstance of birth. Had I gone to her place, I'd have seen the same. Except for me, it'd have been spending time with her tight-knit, loving family. If I had experienced that, would I have stayed away too, avoiding a very different reminder of what could be? Felicity looks around Rockton and compares it to what she has, and it makes her uncomfortable. Ambition is healthy. Envy is pointless and potentially destructive. It leads to the dissatisfied cry of, why? Why do they have this and I do not? It isn't fair. They don't deserve it. They haven't earned it. But Felicity quickly finds the solution to her problem. The only healthy solution to envy. What can I learn from this that will make my own life better? She begins to examine our building construction and asks questions about our sanitary system. We answer, and we continue with the tour. Afterward, we don't invite Felicity to join us at home. Petra will take care of her. We need time to rest and be alone. We indulge in a long dinner for two. Then Dalton goes to the station for a bit of work while I take Abby. By 8, we're asleep. Chapter 37. The next morning, we're off by 7, walking with flashlights into the darkness. Felicity and Petra are with us. Neither says much, and I get the impression that was the state of things last night. When we meet up with Dalton, he says to Petra,
"You got that gun I dropped by?"
She hesitates only a second before nodding and opening her jacket to reveal her personal handgun. If we get into trouble and Petra pulls out an unauthorized weapon, it'll tell Felicity we're lying about our gun regulations. Petra understands this and plays along. We take Storm with us. Abby stays behind. I do not expect that we're going to find unfit parents at the end of this journey. At worst, it might be a young couple who, with great reluctance, abandoned a winterborn child. That's horrifying to us, but it's the way Cedra was raised. And possibly Baptiste, too, and it's been the way of hunting society since time immemorial. If this is the situation, I'll struggle to see them as good parents for making that choice. But I must put that aside and ask instead, what if you could keep her? What if we gave you what you needed to make it through the winter with an infant? If the answer is still no, that they are not ready for a child, then we'll take her. If they want Abby, I'll still bring Cedra back to Rockton to ensure she is her mother. How much of that is healthy caution and how much is a secret hope that we can keep Abby? I don't know, and I'm afraid to analyze. I do know that I will not stand between these parents and their child. It's late morning by the time we reach the area, about 5 kilometers past where we found Abby. Before Cedra left, she told Felicity that this would be a good area to live, where they had camped and hunted and fished with Baptiste and others from both settlements. Cedra framed it as an offhand conversation. "Hey, you know that spot where we all camped last summer? That'd be a good place to live, don't you think? Not that I'm planning to run away and fake my own death so I can be with my beloved or anything like that." Clearly, it had been a hint. A plea, even. Like giving an estranged friend your new phone number in case they find that jacket you left at their apartment once. "If you want me, you know where to find me." The place is a river valley with abundant game and fresh water and mountain shelter. While that sounds like a settler's paradise, and therefore it should already be occupied, it is only one spot in 1,000 just like it out here. It's just a matter of picking the one that suits you best. Like pioneers heading west and choosing their plot of land. The possibilities stretch to the horizon. When the pioneers headed west, they each got 160 acres. Out here, a settler can claim even more. There is no actual claim, of course. Anyone can hunt or fish or walk through your territory, and challenging them on it would be pointless. The territory this couple have staked out is huge, so they won't rush to find exactly the right spot to build a permanent home, perhaps one for summer and one for winter. The upshot is that we're talking a general area at least a couple of kilometers, and that's not easy to search. We split up. Dalton assigns me Storm and Petra, and he sends us to check flat and open areas along the river. Meanwhile, Felicity knows a 6 spots where they camped over the years, and she'll show those to Dalton. We've been searching for over an hour when our paths cross, and Dalton asks to take Storm. While he wanted her with me for protection, she's better sniffing those old campsites to see if she can pick up a scent. Petra and I continue hunting along the river. She's been quiet, but now she says, "I heard you brought Marianne to town." I grunt a non-reply. "Did you get any answers from her?" she asks. "About what the hostels are, how they came to be?" I bend and check what looks like a boot print in well-trampled snow. "I know you thought the council was responsible for them," she says. "Did you find anything to support that?" If she said it with even a hint of mockery, I wouldn't answer. But her tone sounds genuinely curious, with a hint of trepidation. Is that fear I'll uncover the truth? Or fear that there is a connection? Her gaze shudders, giving me nothing. I consider. Then I say, "Tea." Her brow furrows.
What?
I twist, still hunkered down. The hostiles consume a narcotic and hallucinogenic tea, same as the second settlement, who seem to use the latter for something that seems almost like prehistoric rituals.
Prehistoric people consumed ritual hallucinogens, probably because the altered state made them feel as if they were seeing and communicating with their gods.
I nod. Whatever the hostiles have added to the second settlement's brew makes theirs far more potent and more dangerous. Theirs is addictive, and it affects free will. They're happy and content, and they stop thinking about their other life, eventually stop remembering they had one. She listens, saying nothing. I continue. In high doses, or maybe with an added ingredient, it induces frenzies. Heightened id, lowered superego. If you took Psych 101. A strained smile.
I did.
Does that explain the violence then? Apparently, I rise. I believe it's a natural evolution of something that began in the second settlement. They discover this root makes a ritualistic tea. Someone from the settlement experiments and creates a new version and then breaks away from the group or is kicked out and starts their own community, which devolves into what we have today. I wait for her to jump on the fact that I'm absolving the council, but she still seems to be processing, so I say it for her. A natural evolution based on natural substances with no outside influence. I still, however, hold the council responsible for allowing the devolution. Rockton has been reporting hostiles since Tyrone was sheriff, yet the council dismissed the claims as, I throw up my hands. I don't even know what they thought people were seeing. Bears? Settlers? I was told it was both, she says, unexpectedly. That some settlers were more violent than others, and some had reverted more than others, not being as civilized in their dress and their mannerisms. The more extreme accounts were thought to be wild animals mistaken for humans, probably bears. I wait for her to add a justification, a defense. Being 1,000 miles away, the council understandably questioned the wild stories. Like the tales of ancient sailors spotting manatees and somehow mistaking the ugly sea mammals for beautiful women. Isolation plays tricks on the mind, heightens fears and desires. To the council, Rockton's hostile sightings were no different from Bigfoot sightings. Even I will grant them that, and I expect Petra to point this out. Maybe she thinks it's obvious. Maybe now that I've acknowledged my mistake, she doesn't want to rub my face in it. When she says nothing, I continue. The point is that with so many sightings and encounters, they should have encouraged investigation. Better yet, they should have sent a team to investigate. What they'd have found isn't a tribe of happy former Rockton residents gone native. It was a drug-enslaved cult where at least some of the members, like Marianne, didn't sign up voluntarily. She was from Rockton. Her whole party was. The two men the hostiles brutally murdered and the two women they took hostage. Marianne played along, expecting the chance to escape, and instead fell under the influence of the tea. The other woman did escape and was hunted down, tied up naked, and left to the elements and the predators and the scavengers. This is what the council allowed. Petra looks as if she's going to be sick. I don't expect that either. She takes a deep breath before straightening with, All right. All right, what? I say a little sharply. Silence. Then, All right. I understand. And I agree this has been handled badly. I wait for more. When it doesn't come, I'm annoyed, and I don't like that. Am I spoiling for a fight? My mistake with the hostiles and the council has bruised my ego, so now I want Petra to say, I told you so, so I can light into her? Today's hunt has me on edge, and Petra's not giving me the response I want, so I'm being cranky. Forget hostiles and the council and Petra. None of them have anything to do with returning Abby to her parents. I find a footprint, and I focus on that. It's near the riverbank, pointing inland. The river is mostly frozen, but temperatures haven't dropped enough for it to be a solid sheet of ice, and we're near an inlet that's running too fast to freeze. That's why the snow is so trampled. Animals finding this spot and drinking. I definitely saw a boot print, though, and when I search, I locate more.
Humans have used this spot for water, possibly also for hunting. Drops of blood and scattered white fur suggest an Arctic hare was killed as it came to drink. It's been 2 days since the last snowfall. These prints are even more recent, layered on top of animal ones. When I get about 3 meters from the river, the prints fan out, the animals and the humans going their separate ways. I can get a better view of the human ones here. 2 sets, one about a men's size 10, and one a little bigger than mine. A man and a woman, both dressed in boots like what Ellen wore, thick and heavy, with no tread. The human prints lead to the remains of a camp. A year ago, I'd have walked right through it. Now I notice the rectangle where a tent stood. I see irregular patterns in the snow where items were set down. I spot blood under a tree nearby where game was hung and slaughtered. And there's the fire pit. It's only a circular patch of packed snow, but I dig down to find embers still warm. A camp, Petra says, as if just realizing this. I nod. What's that over there? She says. I twist, still crouched, as she heads toward whatever she spotted. When I catch movement in the trees, I start to call a warning. Then I see a dark parka-like jacket on a man Dalton's size. She's looking at something else, and as she bends for a better study, the figure moves from the trees, and it is not Dalton. Petra, I call, my own gun out, rising. She spins to her feet, and the figure raises a rifle. Stop, I shout. There is a gun pointed at your head, and there are 2 more people walking up behind you right now. I'm hoping I'm loud enough for Dalton to hear if he's nearby. We are all armed. Lower your weapon. Lower yours, the man says. He's young, and his voice is deep and seems steady, and I've dealt with enough situations like this to recognize that tremor, the one that says he's in a situation he's not equipped to handle. It's too easy to pull that trigger when you're afraid and angry and trying to pretend you are willing to do it. I know that better than anyone. Baptiste, I say. His shoulders jerk just enough for me to know I've guessed right. Where's Cedra? I ask.
That's my question to you,
he says, in a voice that carries the accent of those raised in the second settlement.
What have you done with my wife?
Nothing, I say. We came looking for you. We're with Felicity.
Felicity,
Baptiste spits, and his gaze turns to me.
She took Cedra, didn't she? Dragging her back to that grandfather of hers.
Petra flies at him. She dives at his legs, knocking him back. The gun fires, not a rifle, but a shotgun blast.
Casey!
Dalton's voice slams through the forest. Gun down, I shout, as much for Dalton as for them, to let him know I'm fine. Put the goddamn gun!
I've got it,
Petra says.
We're both fine. No thanks to this idiot.
And no thanks to the idiot who jumped a kid with a shotgun, I say as I walk over.
I didn't expect him to have his finger on the trigger.
In the real world, people often do. We aren't all government-trained secret agents.
I'm not,
Petra trails off, shaking her head.
Not government-trained, I say.
She only rolls her eyes and holds out the shotgun. I walk past her to where pellets peppered a tree. I dig one out. A buckshot pellet. Just like the one that killed Ellen. Chapter 38. I turn to Baptiste. He's about 18, brown eyes, dark curls cut in a mop that makes him look like the puppy cute guy in a boy band. He's trying very hard to play this cool, setting his jaw and hardening his eyes, but those eyes don't have the life experience to harden. He reminds me of every kid I questioned who got caught up in a petty crime with his friends, struggling to play it tough while 2 seconds from breaking down and admitting he's made a huge mistake. But he'll take the punishment. Just please don't call his parents. Dalton comes at a run, calling a warning before he bursts through as if we wouldn't hear him. Baptiste gives a start as Storm races past. She's a dog, I say, patting her head. Eric, this is...
You!
Baptiste spins on Felicity, who's trailing Dalton.
What did you do with Cedra? Did you take Summer, too? I swear if you heard either of them.
Summer. The baby's name is Summer. That throws me enough that it takes a moment for me to react, and Dalton beats me to it, grabbing Baptiste's shoulder as he advances on Felicity. Even then, my brain throws up excuses. Maybe Summer is a friend or a pet. Yes, Casey, they have a pet dog named Summer, and this isn't Abby's father. It's pure coincidence that their dog is also, apparently, missing. Dalton's hand tightens on Baptiste's shoulder.
You see those guns pointed at you, kid? Those mean don't move.
Just like the one you had pointed at me, Petra says.
You moved, he says.
And could have gotten you both shot up with those pellets, I say.
Those pellets. He was carrying a gun loaded with buckshot, like the weapon used to kill Ellen. The weapon Lane swore he didn't have. Yet Lane also swore he murdered Ellen. A flash of Tomas saying Lane had a friend who died last year. Then Felicity saying she and Cedra hung out with two kids from the second settlement.
Oh, shit.
Questions and theories ping through my brain, and I squeeze my eyes shut and push them back. Gather more data. Work this through.
Where is Cedra? Felicity says.
That's what I'm asking you,
Baptiste says, as they lock glowers.
You took her back to your grandfather, didn't you?
She's missing?
Felicity's eyes snap.
You lost your baby, and now you've lost Cedra?
I didn't lose. Enough,
Dalton says.
Felicity, go sit over there with Petra. Baptiste, you and Cedra have a baby?
Had, Felicity says. Had and lost.
Baptiste swings on her, and Dalton and I both raise our weapons, ready to order him back. But it's only a warning lunge, accompanied by a snarl.
Felicity, I say, sit and be quiet, please, even if he provokes you.
I'm not the one,
Baptiste begins.
You don't get along, I say. That appears to be an understatement. But we need answers, and we aren't getting them with you two spitting at each other like bobcats.
That is really what they look like, backing up, glaring at one another. It reminds me of Diana and Dalton. Diana convinced he's keeping her from me, and Dalton hating the way she's treated me. The lover and the friend as rivals. It doesn't need to be that way, but sometimes it is. And as with Dalton and Diana, it goes deeper to a fundamental personality clash that the competition only exacerbates. I suspect that's the same here, that even without Cedra in the middle, these two never got along. I walk to Baptiste's other side, forcing him to turn away from Felicity.
You have a baby, I say.
He nods, and I see the struggle to remain calm, not to shout that his child is missing and his wife too, and he doesn't have time to stand around answering my questions. The fact that he's trying suggests I was right. He's not usually a hothead who threatens strangers with shotguns. He's backed into a wall and acting out of character.
Is he?
If he killed Ellen, then shooting Petra wouldn't be out of character. Tuck that aside. Focus. A girl or a boy, I ask.
A girl. Summer.
How old is she?
38 days.
He says so quickly that I suspect, if given a moment, he could tell me the number of hours, too.
What happened to Summer? I ask.
The wild people took her.
Petra snorts.
Is that the Yukon equivalent of dingoes ate my baby?
I give her a hard look, but she meets my gaze, her expression saying she's already decided these aren't suitable parents, based on nothing more than the fact that she doesn't want them to be.
Evidence suggests dingoes may actually have eaten that woman's baby,
Dalton says. When I look at him, he shrugs.
I read about the case. The problem with her story was that dingoes weren't known to take children. The problem with your story, kid, is that the same applies to those you call the wild people. They don't have kids. It's against their rules. So they sure as hell aren't going to steal one.
This isn't entirely true. We know Marianne's group prohibited children, but that doesn't mean others followed the same laws. Dalton's just putting Baptiste on the offensive, trying to break his story.
We found evidence,
Baptiste says.
The wild people came and they took her.
They snuck into your tent in the night, Petra says. Plucked her from your arms while you slept.
We did not sleep with her in our arms. Cedra's mother lost a child by accidentally suffocating her in the night, so Summer slept in a box that I built. It was evening. I was hunting, and Cedra was with the baby. She was making dinner while Summer slept in her box right near the fire. Someone grabbed Cedra from behind, put a sack over her head. She fought, but she was overpowered. She heard grunts of communication like the wild people. She smelled wild people. While she was bound and blinded, they took our baby. In her place, they left one of their skulls, the sort they used to mark territory. They told Cedra not to come for Summer. The voice was low, guttural, like the wild people. They said Summer was theirs. Cedra screamed and screamed, and finally I heard her and came running. We found tracks. We tried to follow them, but they went on the ice and we could not.
When did this happen?
10 days ago. We have been searching ever since. A friend is searching too. She used to be one of the wild people. She said she would find Summer, but we have not seen her since she left. And then, last night, Cedra disappeared.
This friend, I say. You said she's a wild person? Are you sure she didn't take Summer herself? That'd be a nice trick. Steal your child, blame it on the others, and then offer to get the baby back herself. Baptiste hesitates. I'm watching for some sign of calculation in his gaze. There are possibilities here that lay the blame for Summer's fate at his feet. Maybe he exposed her himself, pretending hostiles took her. Maybe Ellen did take her, rescuing her from unfit parents. If so, he'll see an opportunity here to blame Ellen, especially if he knows she's dead and can't defend herself. I'm watching for the look that says he's considering his options. Yet when he hesitates, he only seems to be thinking through what I've said, wondering if it's possible that Ellen took their baby. Then he shakes his head.
No,
he says.
When Cedra told her the wild people took Summer, Ellen was confused. Like you said, she claimed they don't have babies. She knows of two groups in the area, tribes, she calls them. Neither allows babies. She thought we were mistaken. Then we showed her the skull, and she said it was definitely the wild people. Her own tribe, judging by the markings. After thinking about it for a while, she said she remembered one woman who wanted a baby. Ellen wondered whether this woman might take Summer in hopes that the tribe would let her keep her. Or maybe she wanted a baby more than she wanted to be in the tribe.
Take Summer and flee with her, I say. He nods.
There wouldn't be any reason for Ellen to steal Summer.
Down south, plenty of people can't have babies and would happily pay for one. His brow furrows.
How would Ellen get Summer down south?
Maybe she didn't think you should keep Summer. You and Cedra have only been on your own for a year. Adding a winter baby seems unwise. His cheeks color.
It was an accident. Ellen used to be a nurse. She said if we didn't want the baby, she'd have helped us end the pregnancy. If we did want the baby, she'd help us with that too. It was completely up to us. We decided to have the child. The birth was easy, and Cedra's milk came in, and Summer was healthy.
All true. Abby, Summer, was indeed healthy and well cared for. And from what I learned from Tomas and Nancy, Ellen had been helping the young couple, just as she promised. So why was Baptiste carrying the gun that might have killed Ellen? I'm not seeing an easy answer here, and I need to set that aside. There's a bigger issue to deal with. Tell me about Cedra, I say. She disappeared last night? Baptiste nods.
When I woke, she was gone. I didn't worry at first. She isn't sleeping well with Summer gone. Neither of us is. She also needs to rid herself of the milk a few times a day. Ellen said that was important. She has to...
He struggles for the words.
Express, Ellen said. Express the milk, even if it goes to waste, so she'll keep producing it for when Summer comes back to us. It's painful, the milk, so Cedra often gets up in the night. I've told her to just do it in the tent, where it's warm, but I think she liked the excuse to...
Baptiste looks away.
It hasn't been easy for us, with Summer gone. Cedra thinks I'd blame her because she was with Summer when it happened.
Do you? That's Petra, challenge in her voice. Baptiste snaps.
Of course not. Cedra was ambushed. Maybe it's my fault. I ran as soon as I heard her screaming, but it wasn't fast enough to catch whoever took Summer. Cedra says she doesn't blame me, and I say I don't blame her, but it's been difficult. I think she's found excuses to spend time away from me, and that hasn't made things easier. When I woke and found her gone, I didn't want to run after her.
He trails off.
You wanted time away too, Petra says.
You did blame her. He spins on her, and I cut in with, Petra, this isn't about you. Her eyes spark, but her cheeks color too, even as she turns a glare on me. I meet it evenly. She knows what I mean, just as I know why she's saying this. She lost her daughter in a car accident. At the time, she'd been divorced, but she hadn't had a good relationship with her ex. Until the accident. Petra had been called to pick up her daughter unexpectedly after having a couple of glasses of wine.
While that impairment didn't contribute to the accident, it was the other driver's fault. Petra blew under the legal limit. Her ex couldn't forgive her and drove her to the brink of suicide. Now she's looking at Baptiste, whose baby was lost on her mother's watch, and she sees her ex, and I need her to back the hell down. We lock gazes, and after a moment, she nods.
Continue, I say to Baptiste.
I knew Cedra needed time away from me, like she does after an argument. I wanted to give her that, but I wanted her to know I care, too. If I left her alone too long, she might think I don't want her around either. I got up and made her breakfast, and then I went looking for her. I discovered she hadn't been out expressing milk. She'd been emptying her bladder. I found the spot. I also found her night torch there, extinguished, and signs of a struggle.
Hostiles stole my wife, Petra says. I let her have that one, and I watch Baptiste as he snaps.
No! I understand you're blaming me, but it doesn't appear to be wild people. One person took her. One pair of tracks. They didn't leave behind anything, as they did with Summer. I followed the tracks, but whoever took her knows how to cover a trail.
Of course they do, Petra mutters. So first you lose your baby, Felicity says, and then you lose your wife.
Dalton rolls his eyes my way. I know exactly what he's thinking. Well, at least neither of us needs to play bad cop here. We have Petra and Felicity for that.
Felicity keeps going. And you didn't even lose them to the same people. That would make sense if the hostiles kidnapped Cedra to feed the baby. But no, it was different attackers. She meets his gaze. Or was it the same attacker? You wanted Cedra, and the only way you could have her was to run away with her. The next thing you know, you're stuck with a wife and a baby.
Stuck?
His voice rises.
Stuck? I would happily be stuck with Cedra for the rest of my life. I'd happily be stuck with her and 20 children if that's what she wanted. And before you accuse me of not wanting Summer, I did. It was our decision to keep her, and I never regretted it. I want my baby and my wife back, and I'm trying to be patient here. But the longer you keep accusing me of hurting them, the longer someone is actually hurting them.
We have Summer, I say.
What?
He turns on me, blinking as if he's misheard. Summer is in Rockton, and she's safe. He teeters, eyes shut, relief shuddering through him. Then his eyes snap open.
You took her? Someone from Rockton stole—
No, you dolt, Felicity says. Why would they be here if they stole your baby? I brought them to you.
I'm not a dolt,
he says slowly, as if restraining his temper.
I had to ask. The same as you had to ask whether I hurt Cedra, when you know how much I love her.
And I had to ask that because I know you have experienced faking deaths. Also, experience behaving like utter fools, reenacting Romeo and Juliet. He sputters for a moment before facing me and saying, evenly,
If you suspect me because of that, let me assure you that Cedra and I are not children who thought faking our deaths would be romantic. Has Felicity told you why we did that?
Because the settlements would have forbidden your marriage, I say.
Yes, but we had a plan for dealing with it. One that wouldn't have left our families grieving for us. We planned to leave together, with notes to explain. And then we'd return in a few years after we had a child so they could not separate us. Cedra wanted to ask Felicity for help. I argued, but she trusted her friend. She didn't even get a chance to explain the plan. As soon as she said she wanted to leave with me, Felicity threatened to tie her up and keep her from making such a terrible mistake.